The Book of Lamentations, Chapter 1, Commentary by John Calvin. How does a city sit solitary that was full of people? How she become as a widow? She, that was great among the nations, and princess among the provinces, how is she become tributary? The prophet could not sufficiently express the greatness of the calamity, except by expressing his astonishment. He then assumes the person of one who, on seeing something new and unexpected, is filled with amazement. It was indeed a thing incredible, for as it was a place chosen for God to dwell in, and as the city Jerusalem was not only the royal throne of God, but also, as it were, his earthly sanctuary, this city might have been thought exempted from all danger, since it had been said, "Here is my rest forever. Here will I dwell." Psalm 132, verse 14. God seemed to have raised that city above the clouds and to have rendered it free from all earthly changes. We indeed know that there is nothing fixed and certain in the world, and that the greatest empires have been reduced to nothing. But the state of Jerusalem did not depend on human protection, nor on the extent of its dominion, nor on the abundance of men, nor in any other defenses whatever, but it was founded by a celestial decree, by the promise of God, which is not subject to any mutations. When therefore the city fell, uprooted from its foundations, so that nothing remained, when the temple was disgracefully plundered, and then burnt by enemies, and further, when the king was driven into exile, his children slain in his presence, and also the princes, and when the people were scattered here and there, exposed to every contumely and reproach, was it not a horrible and a monstrous thing? It was not then without reason that the prophet exclaimed, "How?" For no one could have ever thought that such a thing would have happened. And then, after the event, no one with a calm mind could have looked on such a spectacle, for innumerable temptations must have come to their minds. And the thought especially must have upset the faith of all. What does God mean? How is that he has promised that this city would be perpetual, and now there is no appearance of a city, and the hope of restoration in the future? Is then this is so sad a spectacle might not only disturb pious minds, but also upset them and sink them into the depths of despair? The prophet exclaims, "How?" And then says, "How sits the city solitary, which had much people?" Here, by comparison, he amplifies the indignity of the fact, for on the one hand it refers to the flourishing state of Jerusalem before the calamity, and on the other hand he shows how the place had in a manner been turned into darkness. For this change, as I have said, was as though the sun had fallen from heaven, for the sun has no firmer standing in heaven than Jerusalem had on earth, since its preservation was connected with the eternal truth of God. He then says that this city had many people, but that now it was sitting solitary. The verb, to sit, is taken in Hebrew in a good and in a bad sense. Kings are said to sit on their thrones, but to sit means sometimes to lie prostrate, as we have before seen in many places. Then he says that Jerusalem was lying solitary because it was desolate and forsaken, though it had before a vast number of people. He adds, "How has she become?" and so on. For the word "how" ought to be repeated and applied to both clauses. How then has she become as a widow who was great among the nations? He that says Jerusalem had not only been full of citizens, but it also extended its power through many nations. For it is well known that many contiguous nations were tributary to it under David and Solomon. And to the same purpose is what follows. She who ruled among provinces has become tributary. That is, has become subject to a tribute. This phrase is taken from Deuteronomy 28, for the prophets were wont freely to borrow expressions from Moses. the chief teacher and prophet, as we shall presently see again. We now then see the meaning of the prophet. He wonders at the destruction of the city Jerusalem, and regarded it as a prodigy which not only disturbed the minds of men, but in a manner confounded them. And by this mode of speaking he shows something of human infirmity, for they must be void of all feeling who are not seized with amazement in such a mournful sight. The prophet then spoke not only according to his own feelings, but also according to those of all others, and he deplored that calamity, as it were, in the person of all. But he will hereafter apply a remedy to this astonishment, for when we thus exaggerate evils, we are at the same time sharpening our grief, and thus it happens that we at length become overwhelmed with despair, and despair kindles rage, so that men clamor against God. But the prophet so mourned, and was in such a way amazed, that he did not yet indulge his grief nor cherish his amazement, but as we shall see, he restrained himself, lest the excess of his feeling should carry him beyond due bounds. And then it follows, verse 2, she weeps sore in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers she has none to comfort her. Her friends have dealt treacherously with her. Dare become her enemies. Jeremiah still pursues the same subject, for he could not have spoken briefly in a few words of things so bitter and mournful, and he seems to have felt deeply the ruin of his own country. And when we wish to penetrate into the hearts of those whose sorrow we desire to alleviate, it is necessary that they should understand that we sympathize with them. For when any one stronger than another seeks to mitigate another's grief, he'll be disregarded if what he adduces seems to proceed from an unfeeling barbarity. Had then Jeremiah spoken, as it were, in contempt, he could have hardly hoped for any fruit from his teaching, for the Jews would have thought him void of all human feelings. This, then, is the reason why he bewails, as one of the people, the calamity of the city. He did not, however, dissemble in any degree in the history he related, but we know that God's servants, while they speak in earnest, do not yet forget prudence, for they regard in this respect what is useful, and their doctrine ought in a manner to be so regulated as to produce effect on the hearers. He then says that the weeping of Jerusalem was continual, for he says first, weeping, she wept, and then in the night, by which words he means that there was no intermission. For the night is given us for rest, and God intends some relaxation to men by the interchange of nights and days. When therefore the prophet says that Jerusalem, weeping, wept in the night, he intimates that her sorrow, as I have stated, was continual. Then he adds, her tears are on her cheeks. Some render it jaws, but improperly. The word indeed means a jaw, but it is to be taken for cheeks or cheek bones. Then he means that tears were so profuse as to wet the whole face. It is possible in weeping to restrain tears, but when they flow over the whole face and cover the cheeks, it is an evidence of great mourning. This, then, is a reason why the prophet says that tears were on her cheeks, for he wished to show that tears were profusely shed. He says further, she has no comforter, and this circumstance ought to be noticed, for nothing is more seasonable in grief than to have friends near us to show us kindness, to be partakers of sorrow, and to apply the consolations which may be had. But when no one feels for us in our evils, our sorrow is much more increased. The prophet then says that there was no one seeking to soothe the griefs of Jerusalem. He adds, of all thy friends, had Jerusalem been always forsaken, she could have borne it better when no comforter was present. For we see that miserable men are not thus soft and tender when very grievous calamities happen to them. They do not look here and there for friends to come to them. And why? because they have always been disregarded. It is then nothing new to them, even the greatest adversities, to have no one to show them any tokens of kindness. But when they who have had many friends, and thought that they would be always ready to bring them aid, when they see themselves forsaken, their sorrow becomes much more grievous. This, then, is what the prophet means in saying, dead of many friends, there were none to comfort Jerusalem and her miseries. There is not yet a doubt, but that he indirectly reproved Jerusalem, and by this he understood lovers, as we have seen in other places, for as they thought themselves safe by means of ungodly treaties, the prophets say that they were like harlots who everywhere prostitute themselves and make gain by their lasciviousness, and allure lovers on every side. It was therefore right that the prophet to remind the Jews in his place of that wickedness, even that they had conciliated at one time the Egyptians, at another the Assyrians, like an impudent woman, who is not satisfied with her own husband, but draws lovers from all quarters. However this may be, he no doubt understands by friends those who confederated with them. And who were these? Even those with whom the Jews had connected themselves, having disregarded God, for they had been sufficiently warned by the prophets not to form connections with the heathen. But at the same time Jeremiah sets forth the atrocity of the thing by saying that there was none of all of her friends a comforter to Jerusalem, because all her friends had acted perfidiously. It follows, verse 3, Judah is gone into captivity because of affliction and because of the great servitude she dwells among the heathen. She finds no rest. All her persecutors overtook her between the straits. Interpreters apply this, but in my view improperly, to the captivity of the people. On the contrary, the prophet means that the Jews have been scattered and sought refuges when oppressed, as they were often by the tyranny of their enemies. And then by degrees he advances to their exile, for he could not have said all things at the same time. Let, then, the order in which he speaks be observed. Before he bewails their exile, he says that Judah had been scattered, for many, fleeing the cruelty of enemies, went into voluntary exile. We have before seen that many concealed themselves with the Moabites, nor is there a doubt but that many went into Egypt. In short, there was no country in which some of the Jews were not fugitives. The real meaning then of the prophet here is that the Jews had migrated, that is, had left their own country and fled to other countries because they were subjected to miseries and cruel servitude. Some take the words in a passive sense, even that Judah migrated because they had inhumanly oppressed their servants. But I suspect what was that led them astray. They thought that exile is meant here, and then one mistake produces another. For it would have been absurd to say that the Jews had migrated into exile on account of affliction, and had migrated willingly. For we know that they were violently driven by the Chaldeans. They did not, then, migrate willingly. When these two things could not be connected, they thought that the cruelty of the Jews is what is referred to, which they had exercised toward their own brethren. But the migration of which a prophet speaks is improperly applied, as I have said, to the captivity. On the contrary, means those who had removed into different parts of the world, because this was more tolerable than their condition in their own country. And we hence learn how severely they had been harassed by the Chaldeans, for they had willingly fled away. Though, as we know, exile is hard, we then conclude that it was a barbarous and a violent oppression. Since the prophet says that the Jews thus went into exile of their own accord, and sought hiding places either in Egypt or in the land of Moab, or among other neighboring nations. Afterwards he adds another evil, that they never found rest, and lastly, that they had been taken by their enemies between straits, so that no escape was possible. It must have been a sad condition for the people to live in a foreign land, for we know that such a precarious life differs but little from death. and that there were no contiguous nations by whom the Jews were not hated, and they then fled to such people it was no small evil. But when they had nowhere a quiet abode, the indignity was still greater, and this is what the prophet now refers to. But when we flee and tremblingly turn here and there, it is one of the greatest of evils to fall into the hands of enemies, and to be taken by them, when we are enclosed, as it were, between two walls, or in a narrow passage, some explain the word. So it follows. Verse 4. The ways of Zion do mourn, because none come to the solemn feasts. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted, and she is in bitterness. Jeremiah here refers to another cause of sorrow, that the worship of God had ceased. It hadn't been interrupted, nay, it seemed to have become extinct forever. He then says that the ways of Zion mourned, because none came to the feasts. The words are figurative, for we know that feelings belong not to ways, but the prophet ascribes feeling to what is inanimate. And this sort of personification is more emphatical than if he had introduced the people as mourning. But when the Jews saw that God's worship had fallen, it was more grievous than to find themselves bereaved of children or of wives, or plundered of all their goods. For the more precious God's worship was to them, and the more religion was thought of, and which consisted the eternal salvation of their souls, the more severe and mournful was it to see the church so scattered that God could no longer be worshipped and invoked. It is indeed true that God's worship was not tied to ceremonies, for Daniel never ceased to pray, and he was heard no less in his exile than if he came to the sacrifices with great solemnity to make an offering in the temple. This is no doubt true, but as God had not in vain instituted these duties and rites of religion, the prophet exhibits the thing itself by its symbols, and then feasts were testimonies of God's grace. It was the same as though the Jews were called together by a standard being lifted up, and as though God appeared in the midst of them. Hence, the prophet, referring to these external symbols, shows that the worship of God had in a manner ceased. Her gates, her solitary, her desolate, her priests are in mourning, her virgins in afflictions. She is in bitterness. Now this passage reminds us that when God afflicts his church, however grievous it may be to see innocent men slain, blood shed promiscuously, the sexes, men and women killed indiscriminately, and though it be a sad spectacle to see houses robbed and plundered, fields laid waste, and all things in a confusion, yet, when all these things are compared with the abolition of God's worship, this passage reminds us that all these things ought to appear light to us. Though David greatly deplored his condition, because he was banished from the temple, and did not as usual lead there the assembly, when he was not the only one ejected from the sanctuary of God, yet, when the sanctuary itself was destroyed, together with the altar, when there were no sacrifices, no thanksgiving, no praises, in short, no prayer, it was surely much more bitter. The lamentation of the prophet ought then to be carefully noticed when he says that the ways of Zion mourned, that no one went up to the feasts. What follows I pass over. I shall hereafter dwell more on these things when we advance towards the end of the narrative. Verse 5. Her adversaries are the chief. Her enemies prosper. For the Lord has afflicted her for the multitude of her transgressions. Her children are gone into captivity before the enemy. He first says that her enemies had become the head, and by this expression he doubtless means power. In this way of speaking, he borrowed from Moses, for these are his words, You shall be the head and not the tail, in a high place, not obscured. Deuteronomy 28, verse 13. It then says that enemies were the head, dead is ruled over them. And the opposite of that is to be understood, even that they had become the tail. That is, were under the feet, as it were, of their enemies. And he says that our enemies had acted successfully, even because Jehovah had afflicted her. He here laments after the common practice, as ungodly men are wont to do. But he mixes instruction with his mourning and shows that God, in a state of things so turbulent and confused, appeared as a righteous judge. He then recalled them to the consideration of God's hand, when he said that her enemies had acted successfully, because God had afflicted her. Jerome renders the words, because Jehovah has spoken. He derives the verb from the word which means to speak or to meditate, but this is an evident mistake, as we shall find another presently in this very chapter. There is no doubt but that the prophet intimates that the cause of all evils was that God had afflicted her, even on account of the greatness of her impieties or of her sins. He now then begins to show that there is no reason why the Jews should be swallowed up with grief and despair, if only they considered whence their evils proceeded. He thus begins to call their attention to God's judgment. This indeed of itself would not have been sufficient, but he afterwards points out a fruitful source of consolation. The prophet says that the enemies of Jerusalem had become the head and had been successful. It was a trial which must have grievously assailed the minds of the faithful when they saw their enemies having fortune, as they commonly say, as it were in their own hand. For it appeared as though God showed himself favorable to them. Hence the prophet assigns a reason lest the faithful should fall off from religion and the fear of God. It says that the whole of this proceeded from the just vengeance of God, it being his purpose to afflict his own church. And he does not state this alone, but adds, on account of the greatness of her iniquities. For ungodly men sometimes acknowledge that they have to do with God, but yet they murmur and think that God is unjust and cruel. Hence the prophet not only taught the Jews that God was the author of the calamities which had happened, but at the same time reminded them that they were worthy of such a reward, not only because he had transgressed, but because he had added sins to sins. For this is what he means by the greatness of his iniquities. But he will presently repeat this sentence and enlarge upon it. It is then enough now to state his object. It was for this cause, then, as he says, that her little ones went into captivity before the adversary. It was indeed an indignity, calculated to embitter the minds of the faithful, to see not only the young men but the infants so cruelly treated. For men always think that they have some just cause to contend with God, and especially when the case of infants is brought forward. Who then is not disposed to say that God's vengeance exceeds its due limits? If his purpose be, say they, to punish men for their wickedness, why does he not restrain his wrath? It's to the innocent. For how have miserable infants sinned? But the prophet here checks such audacity and says that God had just reasons for extending his vengeance, even to the little ones. It now follows, verse 6, and from the daughter of Zion all her beauty is departed. Her princes are become like deer that find no pasture, and they are gone without strength before the pursuer. He continues the same subject. He says here that the daughter of Zion was denuded of all of her ornaments. Now we know what was the honor or dignity of that people. For Moses, in order to set forth the greatness of God's grace, exclaims, "What nation so illustrious under heaven?" Deuteronomy 4, verse 7. As then the singular gifts of God had been conferred on that people, it was a very sad spectacle to see that city, which once possessed the highest glory, robbed of all of its honor, and covered with disgrace, as we shall hereafter see. He then says that all her glory was taken away from the daughter of Zion. Now there is no need to enumerate all the kinds of honor or glory which belong to the city Jerusalem, but it may be said first that God had chosen there a habitation for himself, and then a sacerdotal kingdom was there. The people were holy to God. They were his heritage. This is where God had deposited his covenant. He deemed all the Jews his children, and his will was that they should in return count him as their father, as then they had been enriched with so many ornaments and so superior. It is no wonder that the prophet deplored the state of the city when stripped of all of its glory. He then adds that her princes were like famished harts, for deer, as they are by nature swift, when pressed by want, run as though they were flying. Since then the swiftness of that animal is so great, the prophet says that the princes, who were wont to walk with so much gravity, and to carry the appearance of great authority, had become swift, like deer oppressed with hunger, for they also labored under the want of everything. He adds that at length they went away, that is, they fled before their pursuers without strength. He intimates by these words that they dare not to contend with their enemies, but that they were so frightened that they fled, and thus proved that they were wholly disheartened and lifeless. And it follows in Lamentations 1:7, Jerusalem remembered in the days of her affliction and of her miseries all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the enemy, and none helped her. The adversary saw her and mocked at her Sabbath. He confirms a former verse when he says that Jerusalem remembered her desirable things when she was afflicted by God's hand and reduced to extreme want. And he intimates by these words that when Jerusalem was in its splendor, it did not sufficiently consider the blessings of God, for the despisers of God cram themselves with whatever flows from his bounty, and yet do not acknowledge him. For ingratitude is like an abyss which absorbs all the fullness of God's blessings. Then the prophet intimates that when Jerusalem flourished in wealth and in abundance of all things, when it was adorned with singular gifts, she became, as it were, inebriated, and never considered as she ought to have done the benefits which God had bestowed on her. And now, when she was reduced to want, and surrounded with extreme misery, she remembered her desirable things, even the glory before mentioned. For by desirable things he means those gifts in which Jerusalem excelled, as long as God manifested himself as a bountiful father towards it. Jerusalem remembered her desirable things in the day of her affliction, and of her want, or of her groaning, or of her transmigration. For some derived the word, which means to complain, or to migrate, hence they render it exile or migration, but others render it complaint. Others again derive it from the word which means to fail, and render it want, or indigence. Why some have translated it iniquities, I don't know, and there is no reason for such a version. I do not approve of complaint, exile, or want. It's the best word. The days of affliction he more clearly expresses when he says, when the people fell into the hand of the enemy, and there was no helper. We now see what the prophet means, even that Jerusalem was, as it were, roused from her lethargy when God afflicted her. For as the drunken, after being satiated, so sleep in their excess that they know and feel nothing, but seem half dead. So prosperity inebriated Jerusalem for a long time. But being at length awakened, she perceived whence she had fallen. As long then as she stood in her high place of honor, she did not consider God's indulgence towards her. But after she was stripped of all of her blessings and became deeply afflicted, she then remembered her desirable things. That is, she at length began to perceive what she had lost, because she had fallen from the grace of God. We may from this gather a useful doctrine, for what the prophet relates of Jerusalem is seen almost in all mankind. We must beware lest this should be true of us, for God is not only in a common manner dealt liberally until now with us, but he has also been pleased to favor us with evidences of favor, even more than paternal. He has separated us from the unbelieving and has bestowed on us many of his blessings. Let us now then take heed lest we become obdurate while God deals liberally with us. But on the contrary, let us learn to appreciate the blessings of God and consider the end for which they have been given us. Otherwise, what is here said of Jerusalem will happen to us. For being too little awakened, we shall know that we were happy when God showed himself a father to us.